Hello, and welcome to today's program of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club and your host for tonight. Our program tonight, Lessons from a Silicon Valley Pioneer with William Ryan, co-founder and chairman of Niehaus Ryan Wong, chairman emeritus of Craigslist Foundation. Our moderator who will be in conversation with Bill tonight is Christy Dames. Christy is the CEO of Tech Talk Studio and was formerly the director of the Speakers Bureau at Niehaus Ryan. So with that, I would like to introduce Christy, our moderator, and I'll turn it over to Christy and Bill. We do have a special guest coming up at 6:30, so watch for that. And then about 6:40, 6:45, we'll turn it over to you for audience questions, and I will be going around with the mic. Please don't call out your question. Wait, this program is being recorded for a podcast and possible play on the radio, so please wait for the microphone. With that, here's Christy Dames.
Welcome, everyone, and I am honored and thrilled beyond my imagination to be here with Bill Ryan, the co-founder of Niehaus Ryan, which was then to become Niehaus Ryan Wong, who created the category high-tech PR. And I was privileged to be part of that for a couple of years. It was certainly a moment in history for me and for everyone there, as this team set out to change the entire course of technology, communications, and the internet. And so all these years later, I am so excited that you're here. So with that, really. So, Bill, I want to open up with how this magic moment happened. You were a small firm and you met a gentleman named Ed Niehaus, and all of a sudden we have a Reese's peanut butter cup. And so magic happened. So can you talk about how that started? Sure. And then also that strategy. Did you guys have this? Did you meet and then it was magic and the strategy unfolded? How did you figure this out?
Well, I'll tell my side of the story. Ed can always see if, you know, he has his own remembrances. But actually, Ed, I had a small agency on 16th in Vermont, and Ed had a small agency down the street in a railroad car, and we were introduced by a common associate, and we started just having lunch together, and sharing war stories, as you know, you do, and at one point we just thought, why don't we just merge everything we're doing and get going and do new things. Now, so we got together and we were here. We're just a couple people, and at the same time, you're looking around you and you've got the high tech PR. You've got these big agencies now that are kind of dominating technology relations and stuff like that, and the PR industry was really kind of dominated by these bigger firms like High Tech PR and Regis McKenna and that. And so we thought, what should we do? What should our strategy be? So there was a couple pieces to it. One was we decided, let's not go after the business that everybody's already in. We don't want to do silicon stuff. We don't want to do chips. We don't want to do all of that stuff. We're going to look for emerging markets that where we can really get in early and own our, and really build a presence in that. And we really built the agency around three fundamentals. We felt if we were going to be successful, we had this idea of three pillars. One, you needed to know the client's business as well as the client, okay? Their industry. You couldn't be a situation where somebody asks you a question and it's kind of like, you know, I'll get back to you about that, right? You need to really know the industry. The second thing is that we had to own the relationships that mattered to the client. And the third was that we felt we needed to continue to innovate the frontiers of marketing and communications itself. Now, the only way that we felt we could do that was to focus on some very specific markets. And in the early days, Ed had a real passion for software and software design and development. And so we started doing a lot of work in there. And also that was the birth of client-server computing was going on at that time. So we were very early into that space. And so that's how the whole thing actually got off the ground, was trying to be focused on a couple categories as they were emerging. The internet was one of those things that kind of came along, but it wasn't going on when we first, you know, first started off.
So how did you know that the internet would be anything? How were there signposts and you said, we got to look over here?
Actually, you know, it was that third pillar, innovating the frontiers of communications itself. So we would do things, for example, I don't know if you all remember the early days back in the really early 90s, you know, all kinds of tech companies had these forums on like CompuServe forums and that. And so we started doing things where we would hang out in the forums and we'd find out who were the real influencers in those forums that were relevant to our clients. And when we would do a press tour, we actually would take our client and meet with some of these people who, you know, maybe they're just a manager of technology in a particular company, but they were very influential. So we were very early in the whole game of using the social dimension, bringing social and communities into play into the PR process. The second thing I think was around the thing is that in those days, how many people remember the Well? Well, the Well still exists, right? Okay. Well, Ed had been involved in the Well very early. And the reason to be on the Well was in those days, all of the really senior insider reporters, people like Peter Lewis and those, they were all hanging out at the Well because all the geeks were hanging out and all the inside nerdy guys were hanging out in the Well. And they would give leads and insight into what directions about technology to Peter Lewis and these other, you know, senior journalists there. And so we actually started building relationships early on with those people through the Well. Now, the Well was on the internet, right? You had to be able to get onto the internet and using a chat tool or whatever to be able to participate in those kinds of things. So very early on, we started seeing the internet as it was sort of kind of pre what we now think about the internet. In those days, you know, the internet was a bunch of guys with pocket protectors and you know, it was a pretty nerdy place and it was really hard to get onto. But that was, we got hip to the power of the internet very early on.
So did you have competitors back? I mean, you guys were this little group here and then these big players doing something over here. Who are your competitors?
You know, I've always felt that it's the best thing for your business is to have a great competitor. And we had a great competitor, which was Pam Alexander. I don't know if anybody remember Alexander Communications, you know. She was a similar size to us and similar kind of aspirations and different focus, different strategy for the business and that. But she really kept us on our toes. And in fact, I think we heard through the grapevine that she was thinking about, she was planning on doing a website and was like, no way can we not have be the first agency to have a website here. So it actually drove us to become the first PR agency that actually was on the web, that had a website.
Wow. I look back and you're hiring, and I didn't come on the scene till 1997, 96, 97, and you started in 1990. So, and when I arrived there, I saw four heads of four different divisions, and they were all young women. I mean, you were pioneering women, driving, and young women. So how did you think about who you were going to bring on to help do this?
It had nothing to do with people being male or female. It was just who is smart, who is smart and who knows how to tell a story and who gets it, you know. And again, remember, fundamental to the agency was this belief that we really needed to understand the client's business. Okay, and so there was one woman, Sky Kettenden, who's now, what's Sky's name, married name?
Pillsbury.
Sky's, I think, joined us fairly quickly out of college, and just as to answer our phones. And back in those days in the office, the entry into the offices where she sat was just a little bit away from where my office was, and she and it was in the evening, and she was still working, and all of a sudden somebody calls her on the phone and she's chatting with them and you can kind of overhear what she's saying. And she's going, and yeah, and I'm working on, the stuff that has to do with the internet. And, you can almost hear the other side of the conversation going, what's the internet? What's that? She proceeded to give the most concise, thoughtful, perfect answer to that. And I just stopped and thought, Whoa. This woman is incredible. She then eventually became the head of our internet practice and built her own reputation amongst journalists and analysts that just was unsurpassed. And because she was so new to the game, she didn't realize that she should be nervous when she called the executive editor of Fortune magazine. She just did it. And produced all these incredible results and really helped grow the internet team as a whole. So it wasn't, people criticize the PR industry sometimes as, being a woman's business. I don't know what that's any about. I've had the privilege of working with really smart women, and I've had the privilege of working with really smart guys and men. I just think that, we tried to only hire people that we felt really got it and knew how to tell a story.
Yeah. Well, speaking of stories, I know you have a few, and Yahoo and Apple are two really big stories. I mean, you have so many stories to tell, but I'd like to kind of crack open Yahoo for a bit and talk about Yahoo search. How did that all come about? Because you're the crew that,
sure.
took Yahoo.
Well, in the very early days of the internet, there was no such thing as internet world or, that kind of stuff. There was no industry around the internet in those early days. So whenever there was a conference that had something to do with the internet, we would go to it. And there was this event, a conference, two-day conference in Washington that was being put on by MITRE. I don't know if you know what MITRE is. MITRE is like a systems integrator, Beltway systems integrator in D.C. that's probably a front for the CIA. And so we went to this event, and they had an afternoon session called Spiders and Other Denizens of the Web, where they had three groups of grad students that were coming and talking about how do you find things on this World Wide Web and stuff. Afterwards, Ron and I looked at each other and just went, whoa, this is the killer app, okay? This is the killer app. When we get back, we have to find somebody, a company that's doing something commercial with this idea of finding stuff and search and spiders. So we found out about these guys that were all living together on a cul-de-sac, I think in San Mateo, and they had this company called Architects. And we came in and we were basically almost going to give the service away because we felt it was so strategic for us to get early in. The other thing is that we had a strategy already in mind that we were waiting for the perfect client to execute that strategy around. We felt that the internet, to be successful, had to have a new voice. Up to that point, the voice of the internet was people like Vince Cerf and Tim Berners-Lee and, all these guys running around with pocket protectors and they're all nerdy. And Vince Cerf, even in those days, was old enough to be your grandfather. And so we really felt that if the internet was going to take on and get people excited as something besides just a education and government communication, academic thing, it had to have a young kind of hip voice. And so we had this strategy in mind and we were kind of waiting around for the perfect client. So here are these guys all living in a cul-de-sac, all developers except for one guy who was kind of running the company. And we went in and we offered to, do their PR and we wouldn't even hardly charge them anything. And they ended up turning us down because they kind of knew somebody that did this kind of thing and, blah, blah, blah. So we thought, okay, let's just keep our eyes open. And we heard about Yahoo. And at that time, Yahoo was like eight guys in a trailer on the Stanford campus. And so we got introduced. We did a deal with them that they could, they could afford and we could work with and everything. And they were the perfect people for that for that strategy. Two young guys, Stanford, entrepreneurial. They were the perfect package in our minds. And so I suppose they have been told that when I use this term, they really hate it, but I'm going to say it anyways. We took them through the course of the time we were with Yahoo, we took them through, I think, four or five distinct strategies over time. Well, the first one I used to always call the David and Jerry Show. And the David and Jerry Show was about getting these young guys to become archetypes of the new internet. And Jerry ended up really kind of taking most of the responsibility because Philo, he was a very, very shy guy, and he just didn't like the limelight as much. But in the very early days, it was really the two of them, and they helped catch the imagination of the internet. And so I think that was a big, huge thing that enabled us to drive the narrative, into the marketplace. There was another thing that happened was that in those days, the internet was really difficult to get onto. And so we had two clients that we brought together, O'Reilly and Spry, and they create, and we said, listen, guys, somebody's got to figure out how to make it easy to get onto the internet. Your younger people here don't even get this notion, okay, because you grew up in the internet. But in those days, you had to know how to install a TCP/IP stack onto your computer, and then you had to kind of write some Unix code so that it could interact with a POP server someplace and all of that. And so not something your grandma is going to be able to do very easily, right? So they created this thing called Internet in a Box, which all you had to do was put a disk into the computer, and magically now you're on the internet. Okay, my personal opinion is that was one of the most transformative points in the entire industry, because it moved the internet from geekdom to everybody. Now anybody could get on, and then there's the World Wide Web is going on, and browsers are starting to come in, and it's becoming a visual metaphor instead of a text metaphor.
And how did you with Yahoo? Because you started out, it was the David and Jerry Show.
David and Jerry Show.
Uh-huh. And then it was these two young guys. And then you changed strategies later on, right? So as they were growing and you were educating.
They had this idea called go public. Okay. So does two young guys running around the office without any shoes on, wild, crazy guys, doesn't really engender a lot of confidence on Wall Street. Okay. And so we had to switch our strategy, and the strategy actually began to focus more on TK, Tim Kugel, who was actually the CEO and was running the company. Okay, and there was a wonderful cover story that was done on Yahoo at one point, and I think it was on Fortune or Forbes, I can't remember which one, but here's a picture of TK in the center, and David and Jerry on either side, and they're kind of going like this. Now the photographer probably thought they were making a Y, but in my mind, what was actually happening was they were kind of disappearing a little bit into the background, and we needed to build a strategy around the senior management that is running this company, because the company is going to get ready to go public. So that was kind of phase two, had to do with taking them public. And then once they go public, and then there was the whole search engine wars, and we had to re-strategize for that. and then on and on.
Yeah. All right. So Apple, Steve Jobs, the iMac. The launch, I'll never forget the interim CEO word, which was, if it wasn't interim CEO, you were in trouble. But you started with Next and Pixar. You were part of this whole unveiling, as it were. Talk about this.
Next was our client. Okay, we worked with Next. And obviously, if you're working with Next, you're working with Steve very, very closely. And then eventually, if you remember your Valley history, Apple decided to buy Next, because what they were really after was the operating system, the whole Unix operating system, okay? And so the woman who handled communications for Next was our main contact and really liked us, and we worked very closely. She went on to head up communications for Pixar. And then Ed started getting a series of calls at all hours of the day and night from Steve saying, listen, I'm coming back into the company and I want you to be part of the core team and stuff. And we kept going, oh, God, Apple, do we want to do this? Can we go down this road? We finally just said, yeah, Steve. You know, it's like, yeah, we'll do it. It's not going to be easy, but we're going to do it. And so so we committed to do it, and we committed to do it and see it through the whole launch of the iMac. And so so we actually spent a lot of really quality time with Steve. You know, we met once a week, or actually twice a month with Steve in the boardroom along with the other three communication companies that were now part of this core team. There was Chiat Day, who was, if you don't know, Chiat Day and Lee Clow. Lee Clow was the guy that created the 1984 commercial for Apple, right, that was on the Super Bowl. And so now Steve had a long relationship with him and really respected him. So his team was back in the game. They're the ones that actually created the whole campaign around Think Different, okay? And so we would meet twice a month in the boardroom, and everybody would go around and see what everybody else was doing. And it was really helpful because we all were informing each other. So because the whole idea was, you know, at that time, Steve didn't have a whole lot of money. Apple did, you know, Apple's finances were very troublesome at that time. And so he couldn't just – so he was really cutting back and putting all of the wood behind a single set of arrowheads. Okay, that was, you know, that was what was going on. And so, you know, it was a chance to really learn and see Steve in operation. And I always like to tell this story because I think it really shows how Steve is really was so different from almost every other CEO that I've, you know, enjoyed working with over the years. Chiat Day came up with a, Ed, I'm sure he remembers this, they came up with a mock-up of a television ad that they want, you know, that they were trying to develop for one of the laptops. And so they, you know, they put the tape in the machine and on the wire, and we're all watching it. The lights go down, we're all watching it, and then the commercial is over and it's silence in the room, right? And everybody's going, you know, you could hear a pin drop. Everybody was like, what's Steve gonna think? And Steve looked at that and he just was silent for a second. He said, you know, if we were HP or Sony or something, we would probably think this was a really great commercial. But we're not. We're Apple. The world expects more from us.
Wow.
Okay?
Wow.
And, you know, in my mind, I, you know, you could have done a search and replace with this ad and put an HP or something like that. And all those other CEOs would have thought it's a great ad and it would be running on the Super Bowl. Not Steve. Steve's brilliance was that Steve knew the difference between good and great. But because he was so bimodal, there was no place in between absolutely incredibly great and crap. Those were his two states of being. Totally crazy great, shit. And so, you know, and that was his brilliance, to be able to know the difference between good and great. And there's very few CEOs or managers that really had that ability. And that, you know, so, you know, I had great experience. I have, you know, and also with Pixar. I learned a lot by just working with him on Pixar.
Well, and you've talked before about some of the lessons that you've learned both from Steve and from Yahoo, just business lessons, things that you might have done different at that time. Can you talk about that?
How had I done things different? Oh, God, I have a long list of how I would do things different. I think that the lessons learned, what are lessons learned? I think one of the lessons I learned from Steve, and I think our whole team, not just me, when I said we, was simplicity. You know, I don't know if you know how much you know about Steve, but Steve is actually a minimalist at heart. I mean, he liked minimalist architecture. He liked minimalist art. He thought in very clear, unconstructed terms. So God forbid you should give him a press release that was 4 pages long. Okay? You know, if you couldn't tell your story on a page and a half and on a press release, the first part of the page, right, is all headers and, you know, for immediate release and all of that stuff. If you couldn't net it out, he just threw it back at you. And, you know, and it's not like just put in the facts, like it's some kind of fact sheet. It's like, yeah, you have to net it out, but it still has to sound profound. It still has to sound hot. It still has to sound special. And that's where I think our team, me along with everyone that worked on those accounts, really learned. I mean, he took us to task to do our best work. And that's, you know, I think that one of the great things about working with Steve was that he always, you know, if you had the ability to do great work, you could work with him because he pushed you to do your best work.
Wow. Because I watched a family grow up around, I will never forget the massive hiring that had to happen immediately and you, with the standards you already had. And so all of a sudden, this family of people grew up out of nowhere in order to take on Apple. And it was an amazing, just as the witness, but, you know, being able to observe what happened and how that played out was absolutely amazing.
And it took a certain amount of faith, you know, faith in Steve's and his ability to do that. Because you have to remember, Apple at that time, everybody had written Apple off. Everybody had written Apple off. It was, you know, circling the drain. And so it wasn't an easy task to regain trust and credibility in the company, and we had to do it step by step by step to do it. It wasn't just something that we magically showed up and started writing short press releases that were killer. That didn't change anything. We had to rebuild relationships that, you know, had gotten sour with Apple over time. We had to get people willing to, and get developers willing to hold off abandoning the platform, okay, which was a big thing that we, you know, that was happening at that time. And so it was just a lot of hard work.
This is more
relationship building.
This is more than PR. I mean, this is more than press release. This is, like you just said, relationship building. And isn't that primary to everything you've ever done?
Well, I think that that's what this industry is all about. It's not about, you know, it's not about media relationships. It's really about understanding the influencer ecosystem that lives around any company. Mm-hmm. And that ecosystem is made up of influencers like journalists and analysts, but it's also made up of developers and great, you know, people that are passionate about the platform and all of that. And how do you nurture every part of that ecosystem? And so I think that one of the things we always have tried to do, and it continues to impact how I think about this, you know, this work and positioning companies now in my career right at the moment, is that how do you really understand what is that the ecosystem that influences you? Because nobody lives in isolation. And if something's going to become really become a hot thing, it's going to become hot because other people think it's hot, not because you think it's great. Doesn't matter what you think. It's what everybody else thinks. It's what the customer thinks. And trying to communicate the value that you can bring as opposed to just storyland.
Right. And it's almost like user experience has been born from what you were doing back then, because you were, like you said, you were walking and talking to people. You were hanging out at conferences. I love when you talk about what you used to do with conferences. You never went into them. You just stood outside and hung out.
Don't tell Esther Dyson that. I've always had a very jaded idea of conferences. I think that companies should always be there. I just don't think that they should waste a lot of time in the conference room because nobody up on the stage is going to tell you anything that's strategic or really any – there's no inside information that's going to come to you with four guys up on a panel who are demonstrating they have a clear grasp of the obvious, right? I mean, the stuff you need to know is the stuff they don't want to tell any of their competitors, certainly not the guy sitting next to them. And so I always felt that the best opportunities were in the hallway. So I would hang out. There was a conference that used to go on PC Forum, and either Ed or some or myself, or you know, we would either go to that. It was a pretty high end, expensive conference. I don't even know if Ed knows this, but one time I went, and I never actually went into the conference room at all. I just spent time in the hall. And, you know, I got attendees drunk at the bar, and before you know it, they're telling me all kinds of stuff, and, you know, I'm on the computer writing our clients back, did you know? So, yeah, but what does that mean? You know, it really means that with all this social media and all of that kind of stuff, there's, you know, this and meeting people and getting one-on-one with people and building real relationships with real people who then respect you and trust you, that will take you a lot further than having 20,000 of your best friends on Facebook, right? You know, try to get one of those people that, mm-hmm. that love you on Facebook mm-hmm. to help you move next Tuesday. Mm. Okay? Right. That's what separates your friends from your real friends.
So I want to talk a little bit, too, because we have a guest we want to bring up as well in a few minutes. But I want to talk about some of the principles that you learned and strategy, what I like to call the meta ideas that you've taken and worked with for years. You've developed them over years. I remember your architecture of identity. I mean, all these pieces. But what are some of the principles that you've learned over time?
Oh, gosh. I mean... Is Ron here? Ron? I don't know if Ron's here. Anyways, I had a mentor very early on. I was very fortunate. And he told me something that has stuck with me to this day. And we were talking about positioning. And this is one of the kind of core ideas. He said, positioning is defining the standard in a way that it eliminates your competition. I'm going to say it again. Defining the standard in a way that it eliminates the competition. What did that really mean? What he's really talking about is that it's all about owning the context. Okay? Context is the lens that information flows through. Okay? You can have all the data in the world, you know, all the information in the world, but it all lives and has meaning in context. So if you can control the context of the story, the context of how people think about buying something, then the details about your product will just slide in there. So let's say, you know, I don't know, let's say you're selling slacks, and you're saying, look, if you're going to buy slacks, you really need to ask these three questions, right? Now, what are you doing? You're setting the context for decision making. And those three questions are all going to be able to be answered in your favor, and they are not going to be able to be answered in favor of your competitors, right? Because you've defined the standard that eliminates everybody. That was a big, huge thing for me. Another thing that I learned from Ron Richards was that the whole idea of pushing for the breakthrough. He had this idea of the sort of emotional dimension at a neutral layer. You basically had facts, you know, facts about things, spreadsheets are, you know, but there's no emotion there. He's always felt, and he always pushed me to understand, that people do not make decisions based on facts. They make decisions based on emotion. And if you don't believe that, you can turn on the nightly news and you can just see it all playing out in front of us every night on the news cycle. And so... So he had this kind of axis of positive and negative emotion, and he said that, you know, feature benefit is down here. There's no, it's all intellect. Okay, there's no emotion there. So what do you do? You stretch it out, and so on the negative side of emotion, he said you have problems, and the release of those problems is a solution, and that idea in the 80s kind of gave rise to solution selling, right? Well, he felt that was not pushing the boundaries enough. And he said, okay, what's at the outer extremes of emotionality in communication? Well, on the negative side, he felt it was fear of disaster. What happens if you don't buy my product? How bad can it get? Okay. On the positive side, it was about breakthroughs. Okay, so feature benefits, problem solutions, those are kind of linear solutions over time. Things get better. But breakthroughs are like quantum leaps, and they fundamentally change the dynamic of the market, and they change it in your favor. And now, you know, and I can give all kinds of examples, but I think that those were some of the ones that really, really helped me. And then the architecture of identity kind of grew out of our belief that companies, just like people, communicate by telling stories, and our exploration into what makes up a story. So the whole idea of the mandala and the architecture of the identity really identified, you know, what are the eight forces that are at play in telling in a story, in a company's identity in the world. And so and as we did that more and more, you know, it all started off was a way just to get paid for getting the information about the client out of the client. Because, you know, in the PR business in those days, you used to lose money the first couple months because you had to spend so much time learning the client's business. So we came up with this whole process in the beginning of, you know, getting paid for it. And really, and we developed a methodology around it and all of that. Well, one of the big ahas that I had along the way was that when you force a company to get really clear about and really concise about what it does, it actually creates transformation inside the company. Because you can't live, you know, all of a sudden, you know, if everybody, after, if you don't have agreement, then everybody's on a different page and the stories continue to shift around. And so I think that one thing that I learned along the way was what we had come up with, which was in the beginning was simply a communications methodology to get to find out what the company was about and figure out how to tell the story began to evolve, and we started realizing that these were really profound ways to look at the company, and that you could go deeper and deeper and deeper until you really got what was special.
Okay, well, I'd like to remind our audience here at the Commonwealth Club and our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight, Lessons from a Silicon Valley Pioneer with William Ryan, co-founder and chairman, Nihas Ryan, and chairman emeritus, Craigslist Foundation, in conversation with our moderator, Christy Dames, CEO of Tech Talk Studio. We do have a special guest here. Christy, if you'd like to welcome him to the stage.
We'd like to bring up tonight, we have our guest is Ed Nihas, who is the other half of the famous Nihas Ryan. Come on up. Good to see you. Have a seat. This is like momentous.
Not that seat. I have a real chair for you. And the mic's pointing in your direction.
Yes, and the hashtag is not spread.
This is very exciting. Ed doesn't even live in California anymore, so this is really special that this all happened this way. So, Ed, welcome.
Thank you, Christy.
All right, Bill, this is your chance to put Ed on the fiery line.
So, you know, Ed, I had my own experience with Steve.
Mm-hmm.
You had, as far as Yahoo went, you had the, of Apple went, you had the privilege of having him call you at 3 a.m. and, you know, you were sort of the main lead on the Apple side. I spent more time on Pixar, although we kind of both collaborated with Apple. You have your own ideas around Steve and what made Steve good and crazy and great.
You already told one of the stories that I enjoyed that, the you know, there's insanely great, which is lifetime best in category. You will never see it that good. Really, really, really great, which is best in the world this decade, and they're shit, and that's the whole thing. So that was so that was fun to see over and over, and until you delivered shit a couple of times. So things like driving down 280 fast enough that I was braking for the curves to make it to meetings and whatnot. So he calls me. It's Saturday night, and back then people actually called one another at home on landline phones. And the phone rings, and Carol picks it up, and she goes, it's him. And of course, I knew who it was, you know. So we're all, you know, so Steve says, oh, Ed, I'm just so sorry to call you at home, you know. It's, I know you're with your family, and I'm going, oh, this is going to suck. this isn't going to be pretty, because he was, had this certain personality that was look out. And he said, so I said, yeah, what's going on, Steve? And he says, do you get Forbes magazine at home? And I said, no. And he said, I said, I get it in the office. It usually comes like Monday afternoon. And boy, I feel kind of fear going just as I say that, you know. So, and he says, well, I want you to look Monday at Forbes magazine and then call me and tell me why I shouldn't fire you, and hangs up. And Carol's cooking this good smelling dinner, and I didn't have a lot of appetite, and went out and jumped in the car and drove down, and the Palace Hotel had a newsstand in those days, and it had last week's Forbes magazine. I found out later that Malcolm set it up so that Steve would get his copy by FedEx at home on Saturday morning. So, you know, I figured, oh, I'm not going to get a lot of sleep tonight, because we had Apple and Pixar didn't have a movie that year, and we were getting 10 grand a month from them. And Apple, we were getting $225,000 a month, and we had a full floor of people in San Francisco and a full floor of people in New York. And so I'm thinking, okay, am I going to, you know, go in and, you know, say a fond goodbye to Pixar and call some of my friends there, or am I going to be laying off 40 people and, you know, having a really unpleasant experience? And about 9:30, the phone rings, and Steve says, Ed, I'm just so sorry to have called you at home and fired you. And I said, Steve, you didn't fire us. You said we're going to talk on Monday morning. And he says, yeah, I know. But, you know, I was going to fire you. I said, oh, well, I'm sure you'll do what's best for Pixar, Steve. And he says, I've decided I'm going to fire Catherine, who's, I won't do last names, but some of you probably know her, and the woman that Bill mentioned, who's still a dear friend of mine. And I said, Steve, let me see if I got this straight. She was head of PR at Next. You're selling Next to Apple, and for PR, something like that is a really big deal. And so she's handling cutting exclusives, doing all this stuff, and didn't get any sleep for 4 days, Steve. She wrecked her car on the way home on the 101, and rolled her car on the 101 because she wasn't sleeping. And you're going to fire her? I said, fire us, which was easy to say because that was a smaller client. But, you know, fire us, and hung up. And, you know, sitting there with my heart going a million miles an hour going, that was unpleasant. And, you know, figured, well, I'm not going to get a lot of sleep tonight. You know, what, you know, tuned into a movie or something, and then was Carol went to bed, and I'm kind of wandering around, the phone rings, and I pick it up and go, hi, Steve. You know, who else is it going to be? I think it was midnight or thereabout. And it was a whole other voice. I mean, he had kind of different personalities, all of which were kind of different. So he says, you know, you're right. I must really be an asshole. And I'm going, well, duh. And he says, I can't fire Catherine. And so he says, I'll fire James. And well, James was Catherine Boss's boss and pretty high up in Pixar. And of course I said, I'm sure you'll do what's best for Pixar. And what is going on? He says, well, there's a roundup of the computer animation industry, and we're not in it. And I said, you know, I mean, we had well over 100 employees at the time. And I, you know, I don't know a thing about that. I'd be very surprised if, you know, Peter Burroughs knows us really well, and I'd be very surprised if we didn't know about it, if we got surprised by this. But let's see on Monday morning. Well, Monday morning, James got fired, and, you know, and the magazine came, and we looked at it, and the headline was Fox Bites Mouse. And it was basically Disney had not had an animated film worth a shit for 5 years, and Fox had this movie Anastasia, which was a really good picture. And so they were saying, you know, where's Disney? And so, you know, of course, drove down to Cupertino and went up the elevator and kind of, it's the feeling that I actually have right now a little bit right here. And, you know, and Steve said, let me just tell you, I want to make those decisions, you know, for something different. You know, I mean, they've made every decision, and our team should have checked in with him and said. And I figured out later that, you know, he had talked to me about Michael Eisner, you know, as a second father, and as a kid who was abandoned to adoption, Steve had some stuff going on fathers. And yeah. And I figured out later that, you know, when Pixar's distribution deal expired with, they had a 50-50 deal with Disney, and that was what got us the business, because they had some, the way Steve described it, a entertainment industry PR guy who had this Mercedes convertible and drove like this with the phone crooked in his ear. And he got him page 22 in Daily Variety for the only 50-50 deal of distribution that Disney had ever done. And he wanted us to, you know, called us in to fix it. And we got him a full page in Time Magazine. So we were cool and ended up with the Pixar account. But he would want control over that. And so when that deal expired, like 3 years later, he timed it. You know, he really held off on signing a new deal and timed it in a way that that coincided with Eisner getting parked. And so, you know, wild times.
So I would love to hear from the both of you. What were the stellar moments that stand out for each of you, like those high moments when you would just like high five each other or just look and just go, oh my God, I can't believe this. And conversely, what were the moments when you went, oh no, I don't even want to be here in this place. What, for both of you, what were those kind of moments?
I don't think there's any, you know, particular moment. You know, you go into the office and you just deal. You know, you deal the best you can. And a day doesn't go by where something is going wrong or something has gone right. And I don't know, for me, and I'm sure you share the same thing, is that, you know, fine, we're up here and, oh, we did all these great things for Apple. Look at, or Yahoo or whatever. It's the team of people. It was people like you. It was people like Carla. It was other people that we had the pleasure of work. We just had great people that were doing the work. The work is picking up the phone. Did you get my press release? It's building the relationships. It's going to events. And so to me, the high points are when I remember one of my favorite high points was one of the first times we got Yahoo out of the business section. Because we had this idea. Again, remember the David and Jerry show, right? At that point in time, technology was always written up in the business section of the newspaper. So we wanted to try to get out, stop being in the business technology section, because we're trying to tell a consumer story. And to me, one of the biggest high fives that I had and that I remember was when we got into this big consumer, I think it was in the Chronicle or, you know, one of the local papers, and it was in the consumer section and was all about the internet and consumers and this new big thing. And that was a huge win for our team. I had nothing, mm-hmm. personally, I had nothing to do with that story. My job was to help drive the strategy and some of that stuff, but making it happen were the people that actually did the work. And that was transformational. And after that, actually, was when the boys got into People Magazine. And that's when we figured, you know, things are really starting to roll.
Yeah. Bill is being a little humble here, which is a new development. I don't really... Yeah. He had these ways of getting strategy clarified, that the architecture of identity, it was vision, positioning, and voice. And there's a story about us in Fast Company that the headline was, "Branding is dead, long live sustainable identity." And all that was Bill's invention. And, you know, I could sell, so I kind of made some of that. And I could teach. So a high point for me in a weird way was when our first real Steve meeting to talk about Pixar, and we just had gotten this cover story, or not cover story, but page in Time Magazine, and we're in there. Steve comes in to, he wanted to meet our team, and so Blaise Simpson was the head of our Yahoo business, and we're going to have her head that up, and brilliant publicists, and Bill mentioned Sky, and we also had... We like to bring everybody in. So we had a young woman from Canada whose name is not coming to me, who was like account coordinator. And Steve, walks in tennis shorts with his fly unzipped and, sits down and goes, "I don't know why you guys are here. You're a tech agency, and I don't think you know shit about the movie business." These are pretty strong people. Blaise pipes up, and actually we know quite a lot about it. I was the movie editor for W Magazine, and she had this huge thing, Eclipse. He says, "Well, that's a journalist. That isn't PR." And Heidi was the woman's name. And Heidi pipes up and kind of, "Now, wait a minute. Let me tell you what she does, PR and whatnot." And, she's like 23 years old, I think, and in her first job out of college. And Steve looks at her with his head like this, kind of does a puzzle, and says, "I see your lips moving, but I don't hear anything that I can use, And I'm thinking, this will be, let's see how she reacts to this. And, so she shuts up and looks shocked. And a few minutes later, he said something else that she didn't believe. And he, just does this like that. And I'm thinking he likes her because, that's, he tests you. Afterwards, because all of us kind of got beat up, and kind of at the end, I said, "You're right, Steve. We don't know anything about the movie industry, but we already got your page in Time Magazine. We probably figured it out." And he says, "You're right." He says, "I don't know anything about it either. And these guys are teaching me and give it a try." And
I have a sort of related story to that. I had to present our strategic plan to Steve mm-hmm. at Pixar. And the thing about, again, remember, Steve was really bimodal. So you could not have you could not talk about Pixar and Apple in the same conversation. I think Ed would do things like he would call up and, "Steve, I've got these three things about Apple I got to talk to you about." Boom, 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 boom. And then he'd go, "Thanks." He'd hang up the phone, wait 10 minutes, 5 minutes, call back, "Steve, I'm so sorry to bother you again. I know you're really busy, but I have these questions about Pixar. Now, you wouldn't even know if Steve had ever seen a computer. He was this movie mogul. He had a completely different persona.
Well, so did Apple and Pixar. I mean,
yeah.
You know, Apple was – he inherited an Apple that was like – codependency was there, you know, but basic culture at that time. But it was a very extroverted culture, and a lot of conversation and a fair amount of fear, because you know, you get in the elevator with Steve and he'd lay you off before you got down four floors. And Pixar was a very introverted, to my surprise. These are all storytellers and their cubicles. I mean, one guy had a 57 Chevy mounted on the top of an actual 57 Chevy mounted on the top of his, and it was really a knocked out place. I mean, it was incredible to go into, and it was just like a morgue in terms of conversation. It was a very introverted culture, and he has one of his personalities that he had was introverted. So he was kind of matching that.
Yeah. And so here I am. I'm supposed to give him present the plan for the year. And he's kind of going through it, and I'm explaining it, and he's like, "There's nothing strategic about this. This isn't strategic. You don't understand our business." And I'm saying, "Okay, Steve, tell me about it. I'm not in the business of reading your mind. Tell me what your business strategy is, so that we can build plan around it." And what happened in those next few minutes has actually influenced me to this day. He then proceeds, and I wish I could remember all the details of this story, but he goes, "Right now there's four companies that are in the computer animated space. You know, there was Fox, there was DreamWorks, there was Pixar, and Disney was trying to do some things and that." He said, "But to be successful takes 110% commitment. And these companies are these other two companies are not going to be able to stick with it. They're going to actually get out earlier, and it's going to be us against DreamWorks." And he began to describe his strategy almost like a general would describe a battlefield. "And so these companies are going to come this way, and so this is what we're going to do." And the net-net, by the time he finished the story, it was basically the net-net of the story is how Steve was going to take over Disney. Okay? And it all came to pass.
Yeah, Lorene is the largest shareholder in Disney today, yeah. by far.
But the thing he said was it was a very visual. He was a very visual thinker, and so in my own work, you know, I'm constantly trying to pull back and try to adopt those kinds of points of view, and build a discipline around that.
You know, I just have to say that I am feeling so much relief, because for 19 years I have carried my own Steve Jobs story, and I thought I was the only one that had it. And now I know it's not true, but I will never forget you saying to me, "All right, we're going down to pitch Steve Jobs for the Apple account." And like, I'm okay, great. So I'm part of just eight of us going down. I'm in your car, Ed. We get there and we're sitting in the room, and then his two global PR people are there. And then Steve comes in, shorts, t-shirt, no shoes or socks, this, right? So he
and
comes
popcorn.
In.
Fly yeah. zipped, but.
It was
yeah.
great. Yeah. And he goes up to the whiteboard and he opens it and he says, "So now I'm going to tell you why it is that you should take my business." And I'm thinking, "No, aren't we here to pitch him? Aren't we here to pitch him?" And so...
Well, Ed was playing hard to get in the early days.
Well, Apple had stiffed us for $50,000. We'd been their agency before under Michael Spindler. And so I just told him, because I knew it was going to be the baton death march. I told him, you know, Apple has no credit with us. And we ended up putting 3 months in escrow, a rolling escrow of the fee, because I didn't trust them. I mean, you know.
Well, and it was interesting because so this meeting starts and gets very quiet in the room, and I'm a note taker, right? I'm taking notes. I'm hearing Steve say all these things, and I realize he is whiteboarding the iMac, and I'm like, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm sitting here for this." And so I start taking notes, and it gets very quiet in the room. You could hear a pin drop, and I look up, and he's looking right at me. And he says, "If you need to take notes, then you don't need to be in this meeting. And I just put my pen down. And then all the heads in the room turned back at him, and he went on. But I will never forget that moment of pain, ever.
What, you know what?
And I thought, he likes her.
Yeah.
You forgot to tell me that part.
Oh well.
Well, you know, he had this 2x2 grid. I don't know if any of you know this, but he had this idea when he took over. You have to understand what did Steve take over? Okay, it was a company that was going down the tubes. Okay, it was a company in crisis on numerous levels.
He sold all of his stock but one share,
right?
For like $12 a share.
And so he had this grid. He had this grid in mind. It was a 2x2 grid, and it was desktop and laptop, consumer and pro. And his strategy was, he said, we are going to have the best product on the market in each one of those categories. And one of those categories that was empty was the desktop consumer product that hadn't been revealed yet. And so prior to that, as part of cost cutting and reorganization, he had every one of the product managers, heads of departments, come in and tell him why their product was the absolute best product on the market. If they couldn't convince him, he got rid of the entire thing. Boom, one day. He got rid of the we had another printer company that was a client of ours that wanted to actually buy the Apple printer business, and he wanted us to make an introduction to Steve so that they could talk about it. He didn't even want to be bothered. Just get rid of it. And so what do you think was in the empty box? What was the consumer box? What do you think it was in, what the empty box was?
It was the iMac.
It was the iMac.
Wow. That's great.
And we were sitting around, you know, I really wish I could remember the details of this meeting, but we saw the prototype of it. He pulled it out of a box and he says, right now the code name is iMac. Mm-hmm. Okay. We haven't named it yet. And I can't remember who said it in the meeting, if it was me or you or somebody else, and we just said, iMac, pretty cool name. It kind of says what it is. The internet's right in there, and that became the iMac, and then it became the strategy. I wish I could remember who actually said it.
My recollection of it also is that he came up with some really dumb name after that, and you know, he always ate popcorn, and he dumped the popcorn over his head and walked out of the room with the popcorn bowl and popcorn... You know, dropping off him. My recollection of something that he did that I thought was cool that never made any of the bios, but think about it. He walked into all the record labels and said, you know, Napster was killing him. And he said, here's a CD and it's got, you know, 13 songs on it. And you're selling it for about $13. And we'll give you 99 cents a song and we'll handle all the DRM so that... you know, you don't get ripped shortly after they'd had ads. Apple had ads that said rip, burn, slash. And they bought it. And he marched them all into a box canyon and tipped an avalanche down on them. And now in many ways, Apple's the label and you know, Columbia. I don't know if Columbia even exists anymore. You know, what a brilliant idea that he had that, you know, I don't see him. I never saw him getting any credit for.
Yeah.
It just knocked my socks off.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to remind our audience listening at home, this is the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Kevin O'Malley. I'm chairman of the Business and Leadership Forum here at the club. Our program this evening is Lessons from a Silicon Valley Pioneer with Bill Ryan, co-founder and chairman of Niehaus Ryan Group. Ed Niehaus, special guest here tonight. Co-founder of Niehaus Ryan, and Christy Dames, CEO of Tech Talk Studio and formerly the director of the Speakers Bureau at Niehaus Ryan Group. So unfortunately, we're out of time. We've changed our format a little bit tonight because we did have Ed as a special guest from out of town. I'm really thrilled to have both of you guys here. I'm going to ask all three of you as veterans of the PR industry and maybe the what really could be honestly called the golden age of tech PR. One of the questions that people asked before this program was, is PR dead? Is PR, as it used to exist, dead now? What is the new face of PR, and how can we understand what this really means? Christy, I'm going to ask you to answer this too, and then Bill, and then we'll end with our main featured guest, Bill. First Christy, then Ed, and finish with Bill, please.
Is PR dead? For me, the way I see it, because I still work in this industry, is that it's circling back all the way around again, really, to that personal relationship piece, but in new ways, because people are having to be informed about many more things. It's not just a focus on the company or the issue, but it's really those relationships and with people that you never think you even need to know. And that's what I find most interesting. What happened for me as an outgrowth of working with all of you and the whole team that you assembled there was that I realized that how I worked with people and bringing people that have 1,000 degrees of separation to the same table who would never know each other and never even think they needed to know each other. And that, for my entire career, because of that time, is how I changed everything that I did. That people that have no concept that they need to be in the same room and bring them together. And that kind of magic is priceless. And it is still, that for me is how it's happened over time. And that still today is the piece. Don't need to know each other. Yes, you do. Wow, watch the fireworks. So it's a new kind of PR, I think.
Okay, Ed Niehaus, co-founder of Niehaus Ryan.
It's been quite a long time since I did PR. I'm currently teaching compassion to lifers in prison as a volunteer. And I live in Denver, and there's new technology in Denver that's got its whole section in the Denver Post that is entitled The Cannabist. And PR is alive and well in that industry, which is a really fast growth industry. And I'm going to hand it off to Bill to tell us how it's going in tech.
If PR is PR dead, if it's not dead, it should be. I think that here's what I mean by that. Right now, most executive teams think that PR is just media relations. Get me in the newspaper. Get me in the data. You know, in this. And they only can think about two or three places that they think are even important to be in. Okay. Now I'm a judo marketer at heart. If somebody's pushing, I'm pulling. So I'm looking at. Right now, we live in this avalanche of content, okay? I used to be a big fan of pure content management and marketing, pure content marketing. I get how many offers every day for this webinar and download this white paper and stuff. And then I'm stupid enough to print them out. I should have stock in a print toner company. And I never read even a fraction of it. So, and I don't think I'm any different than anybody else. So what matters right now? What matters is the ecosystem, I think. And it comes back to me, ecosystem competency. Knowing how the ecosystem in which your client operates in, and then diving in and understanding what is the value that you bring to each one of those parts of the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, what, and it's about value. Value is tied to relevance. It's not, if it doesn't bring you value, there's no relevance to it. It's not, you know, and so to me, the real challenge of what I now call influencer relations, I don't even like the term PR, because it's just in people's minds, it's so limiting, and it's just a short form of saying, get me in the newspaper. You know, and you talk to PR people, oh, we're going to get you in the blogs and we're going to blah, 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 blah. Well, who has the chance to read any of this anymore and participate in all of this stuff? I'm not saying it's not important and there's not a few people, but, you know, that you need to influence. But you don't need to influence everybody. You need to find out who's really important. And that's why you need to dive into the ecosystem. You build a strategy that allows you to build one-on-one relationships. And so, to me, going to events like this, going to conferences and hanging out in the hall and building real relationships, not amassing 2,500 of my, you know, closest and dearest friends on Facebook or Twitter, That's not where I think things are going. I think things were going retro. Back to what you're saying, I think everything old is new again, and I think it's getting back to the fundamentals of building real relationships with people that can sign checks. Okay, and if they're not the person that signs the check, they're the person that influences the signing of the check. Mm-hmm. Okay, and they're the ones that can understand the value that you bring to their business, and you can net it out. That's where I think PR is, you know, and I think traditional PR is dead.
And one final PR question for you. Before the program, you mentioned to me you have a new ebook that's coming out. It's called Speed to Cool, Mastering the Art of Brand Narrative. Hmm. How do people find that? Is that on your website, and what's the address?
You know, well, I decided if I was going to write this book in the old-fashioned way, it would never get written, or it would have already been written. And so what I'm going to do is I've started writing out a series of chapters, and I'm going to publish them serially as ebooks. And then as ebooks, I can also incorporate podcasts and other things like that. So stay tuned to my website, and I'll make an announcement there about when they're available, or if you just send me an email, say, hey, put me on this list. I want to get the first one out in another month or two.
And what's the web address?
The web address is www.mandala-vss.com, Vision Strategy Story. So it's mandala-vss.com is the website.
All right, girl, that's a little bit of PR to finish out the program tonight. So I'd like to...
It's ecosystem influencing.
Beautiful. Well, I'd like to thank the ecosystem here tonight at the Commonwealth Club, and hopefully you've been positively influenced. Our program tonight has been Lessons from a Silicon Valley Pioneer with our speaker, Bill Ryan, our moderator, Christy Dames, and special guest, Ed Niehaus. So let's thank them all for being here. And with that, I would like to formally close this program of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 113 years of enlightened public discussion. This program is adjourned.